been on his way to an important appointment and managed to convince his doctors that he had to make a phone call. Only after he'd spoken to someone at Hollywood PD, then managed to reach his brother to tell him what had happened, did he give in to the doctors and the sedatives. When he woke the next day, there was something nagging at Matthews, but he was still groggy from the concussion he'd suffered, and a severely dislocated shoulder was causing him immense pain. He simply couldn't put his finger on what was gnawing at him. Not until he was released and on his way home several days later did he remember once again the polygraph exam that he had scheduled with Reveille Walsh. The moment he made his way through the door of his house, he called Jack Hoffman at Hollywood PD. "I'm sorry about the exam, but I had a pretty bad accident," Matthews began, but Hoffman cut him off. "Yeah, we heard," the detective said. "Don't worry, we got somebody else to do it." "Really?" Matthews said, taken aback. Matthews wasn't even sure how Hoffman knew he'd been hurt, for he had no recollection of making the call to Hollywood PD from the hospital. And while he couldn't blame Hoffman for going ahead without him, it was still a bit disconcerting. It would have been better for consistency's sake to have the same person conducting all the polygraph exams. What Hoffman said next, however, took him completely by surprise. "Fact is, I'm glad you called," Hoffman continued. "I wanted to let you know we won't be needing you any longer." Matthews felt his jaw sag as Hoffman continued. "The investigation was winding down," the detective explained. "If the need for any other testing arose, the department could take care of it themselves. Matthews could go on back to Miami Beach." Matthews stared at the phone as the connection broke, incensed at Hoffman and dismayed at the prospects for the investigation. From the beginning, he had pegged Hoffman as a turf-protecting blowhard if there ever was one, but he had dealt with those types before. What was truly disheartening was the response he'd received from Lieutenant Hines when he'd tried to point out how the investigation seemed to be going awry. From the moment that Hines had put him off, he'd sensed that he was battling a prevailing current of face-saving at Hollywood PD. But what could he do besides perform the job he'd been called in for and hope that his results would have some effect? And he supposed his efforts had achieved something. If not for his work, it was possible that a hapless Jimmy Campbell could be in custody right now, desperately trying to proclaim his innocence. There was plenty on his own plate. He had a full-time job in Miami Beach, and he was being called in as an outside polygraph expert on a regular basis by other agencies as well, including Canada's Crown Counsel, the equivalent to the office of the U.S. Attorney General. Also, there was his thriving technical school, the Southern Institute of Polygraph, to manage. In the end, Matthews could only wish Hollywood PD well, offer his help on the Walsh case at any time, and for the time being anyway, go back to work. As Hoffman had suggested to Matthews, it seemed the beginning of the end of any serious search for Adam's killer at Hollywood PD. When Reveille Walsh showed up for her scheduled examination with Matthews, she was questioned briefly about her activities on the day that Adam was taken. She was told that her polygraph would have to be rescheduled, and on the following Monday, September 14th, an examiner from the Broward County State Attorney's Office conducted the exam. Once again, Reveille recounted the events of the day that her son disappeared, and the examiner confirmed that she had passed. There were no signs of deception anywhere in her account. A few days later, detectives returned to the Sears store to re-interview the employees who had been working the day of Adam's kidnapping, but the results were fruitless. On September 22nd, there was a brief flurry of excitement when a St. Lucie County Sheriff's Department detective phoned Hoffman to relay a tip that a Fort Pierce woman named Mary Green was involved in the kidnapping of Adam Walsh. According to the tipster, Green had knowledge as to who had actually killed the boy. It took Hoffman and Hickman a few days, but on September 30th, the two traveled to Fort Pierce in St. Lucie County, just south of the spot where Adam's severed head was pulled from the canal. They spoke with St. Lucie County detectives and then interviewed Mary Green and her live-in lover, J.A. Childress, whom local authorities identified as the source of the tip. Green admitted to the detectives that she was a chronic alcoholic. In fact, she had spent a couple of nights in the Fort Pierce Detox Center shortly before the time of Adam's disappearance. Like everyone else, she had heard all about the crime, but she certainly had no involvement in the matter, nor did she know anyone who did. She explained to Hoffman and Hickman that Childress, the man who had turned her in, was also a drunk and prone to all sorts of deception. He was upset with her at the time and simply decided to tell people she'd been involved in the kidnapping. Though by now it seemed a waste of time, Hoffman and Hickman arranged for the St. Lucie County Sheriff's Department to administer a polygraph examination to Green. When the examiner was finished, what already seemed apparent to the detectives was confirmed. Mary Green might be a hapless loser, but she had nothing to do with the kidnapping and murder of Adam Walsh. It was as if the trip to St. Lucie County had sapped the last energies of the Hollywood PD. An internal supplemental report dated October 5, 1981, gave a terse, if somewhat inelegant, statement of the obvious. As of this date, this agency has not received any substantial leads that would implicate anyone to the crime. 9 days later, Detectives Hoffman and Hickman, acting on a tip, interviewed a man named Charles Elkwartzel, the owner of a blue Ford van. But as it turned out, being in possession of such a vehicle in South Florida at the time was Elkwartzel's only misstep. On October 22nd, Hoffman and Hickman called in Jimmy Campbell to cover areas possibly not covered in the previous interview conducted by Mr. Joe Matthews, but that came to nothing as well. For all intents and purposes, and less than 2 months after the incident, the active investigation of the abduction and murder of Adam Walsh was at a standstill. Jacksonville, Florida, July 28, 1981. When Otis Toole returned to Jacksonville following his late July 1981 foray into South Florida, his life resumed without a hitch. He returned the Cadillac he had borrowed from the Reeves roofing compound without anyone having noticed it missing. And though his brother Howard and his sister-in-law Georgia had tried to file charges against Otis for the theft of their pickup truck that was abandoned in Delaware, the Florida State Attorney's Office found the case too shaky to prosecute. With his mother's house a charred ruin, Toole needed a new place to live. So he rented a room in a blue-collar rooming house owned by a woman named Betty Goodyear. Toole then reconnected with his erstwhile wife, Rita, and convinced her to move in with him on July 31st. At about 4 p.m. the following day, Rita, 24 years Toole's senior, glanced out the window of their room to see a familiar-looking man striding up the sidewalk. "Hey, looks like your brother Howard's here," Rita said, turning. But Otis was in full flight out the back door. Howard was about to knock, but when he heard the back door bang, he realized it would be a waste of time. He vaulted off the porch and lit out after Otis, who was running down Market Street for all he was worth. Otis made it as far as the entrance to a little Champ convenience store on the corner before his brother caught up with him. "Someone's going to shoot me," Otis cried to the clerk as he burst through the door. "Go ahead and call the cops," Howard added as he ran in on Otis's heels. He snatched Otis by the collar and began slapping him. "This son of a bitch stole my truck." The encounter might have given Howard Toole some minor satisfaction, but as the cops who arrived to quell the disturbance soon pointed out, there were no grounds upon which they could take Otis into custody. For his part, Otis had no interest in pressing assault charges against his brother, and the matter ended for the time being with Howard skulking off and Otis figuring he'd taken his rightful lumps. In the days that followed, Toole got by doing yard work for Goodyear at her various properties and helped out as best he could in her office, though the fact that he could not read well limited his usefulness there. He also found employment at the modest parish of the Church of God on Ramona Boulevard, where Pastor Cecil Wiggins paid him $17.50 for lawn maintenance one day late in August, and another $22.75 on the next. In the meantime, Betty Goodyear's son, James Redwine, had returned home from some kicking around in Miami of his own, and he and Otis were soon hanging out together, sometimes cruising the streets in an older model Cadillac. One evening, Toole showed Redwine a .22 caliber pistol that he pulled from under the seat of the caddy. He told Red Wine he was thinking of using the pistol to kill a couple of drifters who had been hanging around a local park. Red Wine, who had also seen a large wooden-handled knife under the seat of the caddy, didn't know if Otis was serious about killing anyone, but he did see him fire a shot over the head of one of Goodyear's tenants shortly thereafter. "What was that all about?" Red Wine asked Tool as the tenant hightailed it in terror down the street. "The guy just pissed me off," Otis said. Early in October, with the car theft charges dropped, Otis Tool's former lover, Henry Lee Lucas, was finally released by Pikeville, Maryland authorities. Lucas made his way back to Jacksonville, and before long found Otis and was able to explain where he'd been all this time. Lucas had not abandoned Otis for his niece, Frida. The separation was just bad luck, and once he'd been thrown in jail, there was no way for him to get in touch. As to Frida and nephew Frank, they were now in foster care somewhere in Polk County down by Tampa. The children's mother had died of a drug overdose that might have been a suicide, and they'd spent a few weeks in the custody of their stepfather, A.J. Carr, until Frida told Child Protective Services that Carr was physically abusing her. When a polygraph exam confirmed Frida's story, Health Rehabilitation Services had stepped in to take custody of the children. All grim news by most standards, but in the world of Otis Tool and Henry Lee Lucas, it was just the ordinary stuff of life. Otis was happy to know that Lucas had not forsaken him, of course. Things had not worked out so well between him and Rita, and before long he and Lucas had moved into another of Betty Goodyear's rooming houses. He and Lucas worked together for Reeves Roofing for one day right before Christmas, and then Otis managed to get Goodyear to hire Lucas as a fellow maintenance worker. Indeed, 5 months after they'd split up and Tool had gone to South Florida on his little fling, things seemed to be working out for the two of them. There was a troubling incident at one of Goodyear's properties right after the new year, however. At about 10 o'clock on the night of January 4th, 1982, a fire broke out in one of the bedrooms of a house she owned at 117 East 2nd Street near downtown Jacksonville. When firefighters responded, they found 65-year-old George Sonnenberg unconscious in the room next to the vacant quarters where the fire had broken out, second and third degree burns covering most of his body. Another tenant had suffered burns to his hands while trying to escape through a blazing door, and a third had broken his leg jumping from an upstairs window. Sonnenberg lingered in the hospital for a week before dying on January 11th. Fire marshals ruled it an accident. About the same time, James Redwine, Betty Goodyear's son, overheard Otis Tool and Henry Lee Lucas cooking up a plan that seemed sure to land them in serious trouble. They'd discovered the whereabouts of Becky Powell, now living with foster parents in Auburndale, a small town about halfway between Tampa and Orlando, 2 or 3 hours from where they sat. "Me and Henry Lee'll go on down to Auburndale," Otis explained to Redwine, "and we'll bring Becky on back." But what if the foster parents she was living with objected, Redwine wondered. Tool smiled at Henry Lee before he answered, "What do you think, you dumbass? Anyone tries to stop us, we'll just kill them." Redwine tried to talk the pair out of the plan, but they were resolute. As Tool explained to Redwine, he and Henry Lee had pulled off far more difficult things in the past. A few days later, as they were about to get into Otis's car and head out for Auburndale, the front door of their rooming house on East 7th Street flew open, and Redwine heard a female voice shouting, "Uncle Otis! Henry Lee!" It was 14-year-old Frida Becky Powell, with her arms outstretched, overjoyed to see Uncle Otis and Henry Lee again. To Redwine, it seemed a miracle. But authorities in Auburndale were well aware of Frida's history with Otis Tool and Henry Lee Lucas, and it was not long before investigators were nosing around Betty Goodyear's office, wondering if anyone had seen a young woman matching Frida's description. If Tool wasn't sure what to do next, Frida and Henry Lee had no difficulty making their decision. According to Redwine, the pair had been gone from Jacksonville for 2 days before Tool realized that they had skipped out on him once again. Tool, whose only real loves in life were his mother, his niece, and Henry Lee, took it hard. He paced his room for days, muttering to himself, and then, after buying a white-on-white two-door Cadillac from Spencer's Motors in Jacksonville, he disappeared. Toole spent some time out west, made a few brief acquaintances in Louisiana, then finally turned up again in Jacksonville, where he was arrested on September 22, 1982, for driving without a valid driver's license. On November 1st, he was arrested again by sheriff's deputies on the same charge, giving his address as 217 East 3rd Street and the name of his employer as Betty Goodyear. Toole was through with wandering. He rekindled his relationship with Goodyear's son, James Redwine, and picked up his threadbare existence in Jacksonville, where he'd left it a year before, though still without Lucas and Becky at his side. It is hard to say how long he might have carried on as it appeared he always had, just one more figure on the margins of life, managing somehow to stay afloat. But the truth beneath the surface of Toole's dismal existence was far darker than anyone might have suspected. Rotten teeth, unkempt hair, rank breath, and filthy clothes? Check. Borderline intelligence, a bad attitude, poor coping skills? On the mark. Friends? None. Acquaintances? Few. Skills? Non-existent. Prospects? Nil. All dismal enough, perhaps, but what Toole had hiding in the wings made those attributes seem the stuff of a Disney hero in comparison. And if he hadn't finally had a little truly bad luck, the horror show side of Otis Toole might never have been known. Jacksonville, Florida, May 31, 1983. Until the passage of the Uniform Holidays Bill in 1968, Memorial Day was always celebrated on May 30th, a time set aside to honor U.S. men and women who died while engaged in military service. As John Logan, the Commander-in-Chief of the Grand Army of the Republic, wrote in his 1868 General Order, the purpose of Decoration Day, as it was originally known, was to fly the flag and strew graves with garlands in proud memory of all those heroes who had made their breasts a barricade between our country and its foe. Over time, Memorial Day has become a somewhat trivialized occasion, its luster dimmed by a series of unpopular wars over the past half century, and its date now shifting year by year to coincide with the last Monday in May. Perhaps a weary workforce and school population now welcome a 3-day weekend as an unofficial kickoff to the summer season, but surely the holiday achieves little to instill the sense of honor, duty, and sacrifice it was designed for. Certainly there was no such apparent effect on James Redwine, Otis Toole's sometime companion, and pal Charles Hammock, two juveniles picked up by police the afternoon following the holiday's observance in Jacksonville in 1983. That morning, Redwine and Hammock had expressed their own holiday passions by setting fire to an unoccupied house at 1203 Hubbard Street. Tipped off by an informant, police tracked down the pair, who quickly admitted setting fire to both the Hubbard Street house and another unoccupied house in the same neighborhood of Springfield a week earlier. However, Redwine told officers, they had help in these arsons. A man named Otis Toole, an erstwhile boarder in his mother's various rooming houses, had convinced them that burning down houses could be great fun, and they had gone along. Accordingly, officers set out looking for Toole, who offered no resistance when they finally picked him up the following Monday, June 6th. In fact, Toole not only confessed to the two arsons in question, but told police that he had set dozens of fires in Jacksonville over the past 20 years, most of them in vacant buildings. He rode along with officers through a series of downtrodden neighborhoods, identifying 36 such sites where arson had been suspected, including his mother's house at 708 Day Street. He'd been setting fire since he was 9, he told police, doing it to keep blacks out of the neighborhood, and also because it turned him on sexually. During a court-ordered psychological examination, Toole told Dr. Ernest Miller that setting fires allowed him to fantasize sex, and that he would characteristically watch the blazes from a distance and masturbate. He told the doctor that he was a homosexual, but claimed that while he enjoyed the company of children, he had never consummated a sexual relationship with a child. He also told the doctor that he'd been suffering seizures from the time in his childhood when he'd been struck in the head with a rock. He'd been taking Dilantin for years, he said, and was accustomed to drinking a little whiskey each night, about half a pint, plus several six-packs. He told Miller that he had been suffering from depression for more than 2 years since the death of his mother, and admitted that the overdose of pills that had landed him in the hospital in Newport News was, in fact, a suicide attempt. At times he fancies he hears voices saying he should kill himself and go to rest, Miller wrote, adding that Toole was unclear as to whether the voices came from his own mind or from the devil. While Toole told the doctor that he thought his memory was poor and that he had trouble thinking, Miller adjudged that his basic cognitive functions were intact and that he exhibited only minor memory problems related to immediate recall. Can tell time and is of average native intelligence, Miller said, is able to register, store, and retrieve data fairly well. The doctor's clinical impression was that Toole exhibited borderline character disorder and that while he was a severely disturbed man, he was nonetheless competent to stand trial. Meanwhile, Miller recommended that Toole receive treatment for psychosexual conflicts, pyromania, and alcoholism drug dependency. While Toole received no formal treatment for his problems, he was awarded a speedy trial where he was summarily convicted of the 2 May arsons he confessed to in his Springfield neighborhood. He received a 15-year sentence for one fire and a 5-year sentence for the second, with the terms to run consecutively. On Thursday, August 11, 1983, he was received at the Union Correctional Institution at Rayford, Florida. At the age of 36, and with a lifetime of bad news behind him, the tide of Otis Toole's fortunes had finally begun to turn. At the same time that Toole arrived at Rayford, his former partner Henry Lee Lucas was facing serious difficulties of his own in Texas, where he and Becky Powell had gone when they'd fled Jacksonville back in 1982. Lucas had been arrested in Stoneburg, a hamlet northwest of Fort Worth near the Oklahoma border, on June 11, 1983, suspected in the murder of a woman named Catherine Powell. Powell had been discovered in her rural home outside Tyler, Texas, the previous summer, sexually abused and shot once in the head. In addition, Lucas had been questioned by Ouachita Parish, Louisiana detective Jay Villa about a series of unsolved murders in the county seat of Monroe and elsewhere in the area. Finally, Lucas began to crack. He admitted that he had killed Catherine Powell the previous August, and he also said that he had killed Otis Toole's niece Becky, then 15, in Denton, Texas, a few days later. Lucas would eventually claim responsibility for more than 200 murders, though he also told police that he had been assisted in several of the crimes by a man from Jacksonville, Florida, named Otis Toole. While authorities were uncertain as to just how much credit to give these claims, police with dead-end cases from around the South were soon on their way to Texas to speak with Lucas. One such detective was Buddy Terry from the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office Homicide Unit. On Thursday, August 11th, during an interview with Terry, Henry Lee Lucas confessed to the murder of 8 women in Jacksonville between 1979 and 1981. Lucas also recounted another crime to Terry, one that involved Otis Toole. He'd been with Toole when he set fire to one of Betty Goodyear's rooming houses, Lucas told Terry. Toole was upset with several of the men who lived in that particular house because they would not respond to his sexual advances, Lucas said. While Lucas watched, Toole took a can of gasoline from the trunk of his car, made his way into a vacant back bedroom of the house, doused the room with the fuel, and lit it with a match. Lucas told Terry that the two of them drove around the block several times, watching as the flames built, firemen responded, and residents leaped from windows. Lucas said that they also watched as EMS technicians dragged resident George Sonnenberg to the front porch and worked desperately to revive him. From Toole's point of view, Lucas assured Terry, things could simply not have turned out better. Jacksonville, Florida, August 30th, 1983. Following his interview with Henry Lee Lucas in Texas, Detective Terry returned to Jacksonville and made arrangements with Florida prison authorities to interview Otis Toole at Rayford. Understandably, Terry was eager to learn whether Toole had in fact been complicit in the various crimes, as Lucas claimed, or whether the convicted arsonist might simply be a convenient scapegoat for a guilty man to use in easing his own burden. On August 30, 1983, Terry met with Toole at the prison's reception and medical center. There, Toole confirmed that he had known Lucas since 1979 and that he had, in fact, been in love with him. He and Lucas had shared a homosexual relationship, Toole said, and the two of them had traveled together to several parts of the country. As to the rooming house fire, Toole told Detective Terry that not everything that Lucas had said was true. For instance, Toole wanted Terry to know that he had not doused that vacant bedroom with gasoline before setting it ablaze. Given his experience in starting fires, he explained, there was no need for such trouble. He had set the fire, sure, but to get it going, he had simply torn the cover off a foam mattress and set that highly flammable substance ablaze with a match. And while he was aware that several men lived in the building, he had no idea that anyone, including the unfortunate George Sonnenberg, was home at the time. It was simply Sonnenberg's tough luck. So if Toole hadn't set out with the intention of harming Sonnenberg, Terry wondered, then why had he set the fire in the first place? The question brought a guileless smile to Toole's face. Setting fires just made him feel good, he told Terry. He guessed he'd set a couple hundred of them around Jacksonville over the past few years. Detective Terry nodded, finished up his notes, and gave Toole a smile of his own. You're under arrest for arson, he began, but Toole simply shrugged. I'm already here for that, he said, indicating their Spartan surroundings. And for the murder of George Sonnenberg, Terry concluded. The fool's luck that Otis Toole had enjoyed all his life had finally run its course. 9 days later, on Thursday, September 8, 1983, Toole was indicted in Jacksonville on charges of murder and arson, and on September 13th, he was transferred from Rayford to the Duval County Jail to await trial. It is hard to know if Toole felt anything similar to the apprehension or fear that most individuals might experience at such heightening of circumstance, but judging from the conversations he had with some of his cellmates and other detectives drawn to interview him in his new quarters, it does not seem that he was guarded or fearful. He seemed happy to discover that among his fellow prisoners in the Duval County lockup were two old friends from his days in the early 1980s at Reeves Roofing, Bobby Lee Jones and James Collins, a man who also used the alias of Julius Wilkes. Toole chatted freely with Jones and Collins/Wilkes about the circumstances that had finally led him to jail, and when a Brevard County detective named Steve Kendrick showed up to interview him about an unsolved homicide that had taken place in Cocoa Beach, some 2.5 hours to the south, Toole was even more forthcoming. During the interview, which took place on Monday, October 10, 1983, Toole readily confessed to Kendrick that he had probably committed or taken part in at least 65 murders, though he didn't have any recollection of the Cocoa Beach case that Kendrick had come to talk about. After a half hour or so, Kendrick sensed that he was getting nothing useful regarding his own case out of Toole and turned his tape recorder off. As the detective was packing up to leave the interview room, some switch seemed to flip inside the man who had just a few moments before admitted to killing scores of people. According to Kendrick, Toole suddenly straightened in his chair and looked up at him intently. You're from Fort Lauderdale, right? No, Kendrick shook his head. It occurred to him that Toole had confused Brevard County with Broward County, 2 hours farther south along the coast. But being an able cop, Kendrick was not about to let it drop. Were you expecting someone from Fort Lauderdale? He asked Toole. Toole nodded. You get into something in Fort Lauderdale? The detective prompted. Yeah, I did, Toole said. Given that the man in front of him had readily identified himself as a serial killer, Kendrick might not have thought too much of the exchange were it not for the sudden shift in Toole's behavior. He was gripping the sides of his chair tightly now, shifting uneasily from side to side, his gaze dropping abruptly from Kendricks to the floor and back again. As his case notes make clear, Kendricks sensed that he had stumbled onto something big. Reporting agent felt that for a man to admit involvement in 65 murders but get upset about Fort Lauderdale, it had to be something appalling. Kendricks sat back down across from Toole and folded his hands in front of him. "Why don't you tell me about it?" the detective said, and Toole began to do just that. He had found a little boy at a Sears store, Toole said, and told the boy that he had some candy and wanted to talk to him, and convinced him to get in his Cadillac out in the parking lot. Toole told Kendrick that he was intending to take the boy back to Jacksonville and raise him as his own son, but it all changed when this Adam started crying and saying he wanted to get out of the car. The boy's behavior made him mad, Toole explained, and so he hit him in the face to shut him up. And then he turned off the highway onto a dirt road that had a fork at the end of it. And that was where he murdered this Adam and cut off his head and threw it into a pond somewhere along the side of the road. In hindsight, one might wonder why such a statement did not mark the end of the hunt for the killer of Adam Walsh then and there. True, Detective Kendrick was from another jurisdiction and was only vaguely familiar with the case, and there would understandably be a bit of time for sorting out just what Otis Toole was talking about. But surely, one might think, a speedy resolution of the matter was at hand. As the old saw goes, however, that is the trouble with assumptions. In truth, the trouble was just getting underway. When Kendrick left the room after his second interview with Toole, he was a man on a mission. He found Detective Buddy Terry in his office and quickly shared the news. "He's talking about killing a child down in Broward County," Kendrick told Terry. "He says he cut him up and left the body in two different places. This is all out of the clear blue sky." Terry remembers the moment well, though at the time he was not familiar with any child-killing case in South Florida. If nothing else, Terry's obliviousness speaks volumes about how times have changed. Still, based on Kendrick's certainty that Toole was confessing to a gruesome crime that he had in fact committed, he began calling various agencies in Broward County. "I finally got hold of the Hollywood Police Department," Terry recalls, "and they told me that it sounded like the Adam Walsh case." Terry had no idea what Hollywood was talking about, but once it had been explained to him, he hurried to Kendrick with the news. The following morning, October 11th, Kendrick reached someone in the homicide division at Hollywood PD and gave a brief account of what he'd come across. "I identified myself as an investigator for the Brevard County Sheriff's Office," he says, "and said that I had just interviewed an individual pertaining to a homicide I was investigating. During the interview with the individual, he said a number of things that led me to believe that he is in fact the one who killed Adam Walsh." Whomever Kendrick spoke to took the information and said that someone would be back in touch immediately. But immediately seemed to have a relative meaning. "Probably a week after that," Kendrick says, "I got a call from someone and we spoke briefly about my conversation with Otis Toole about Adam. I don't believe I had any additional contact with them, the Hollywood PD, after that. I think I only spoke to them once." With notification having been made to the Hollywood PD, there was nothing more for Detectives Kendrick or Terry to do regarding the Adam Walsh case. Kendrick returned to his office in Brevard County, and Terry went off to Louisiana to confer with authorities there pertaining to Henry Lee Lucas and his own investigation of the murder of George Sonnenberg. As a result of the information shared during Terry's trip to Monroe, three detectives from Ouachita Parish, Louisiana, traveled back to Jacksonville with him to interview Toole regarding the murder of 16-year-old Sherry Alford in Monroe. On Tuesday, October 18, 1983, Detective Jay Villa, who'd been among the first to question Henry Lee Lucas following his arrest, began his pre-interview conversation with Otis Toole while Toole was eating his lunch. Villa casually asked Toole when he was going to start talking about all the blacks that Henry Lee Lucas claimed the two of them had killed. Toole broke off from eating to smile his Alfred E. Newman-like smile. Surely Villa understood why he wasn't about to start talking about that subject, Toole told the detective. The population of the Duval County Jail was about 90% black. How long did Villa think Toole would last if he started bragging about killing brothers? Villa nodded in appreciation of Toole's wisdom. But he'd also heard some rumors that Toole had killed a bunch of kids during his travels across the country, he said. Kid killers weren't very popular in prison either. Were those rumors true? Villa wondered. At that, Villa recalls, Toole's manner suddenly changed. He stopped in mid-bite and put down his chicken leg. "You talking about the kid that got his head cut off around West Palm Beach, Florida?" Toole said guardedly. Villa checked his watch, noting that it was 3:20 in the afternoon. Toole had become a different person instantaneously. For the first time, he made direct eye contact with Villa and inquired again in a somber voice whether or not he was talking about the kid he had killed in South Florida. "What kid are you talking about?" Villa asked. Toole pulled his knees up to his chest and began to weep. "It was the kid he got from the Sears store," he explained. Villa was genuinely puzzled. He'd just been baiting Toole, and he'd certainly heard nothing of any child murder case in Florida. In fact, his conversations with Detective Terry of Jacksonville had been confined to the Alford case connecting Toole and Henry Lee Lucas. "I don't know what you're talking about," Villa told Toole. By this time, Toole was racked with sobs. He thought Villa wanted to know about the kid he'd grabbed from the Sears store, the one whose head he'd cut off, Toole said. At that point, Villa went to the door of the interview room and called to Buddy Terry, who was standing down the hallway talking with Lieutenant Joe Cummings of the Monroe Police Department, who had come over with Villa to interview Toole. "You'd better come in here," Villa told Terry and Cummings. "He's just confessed to killing a child in South Florida." While Terry quickly realized what Toole must have been talking to Villa about, there was no point in getting into a discussion with him at the moment. He simply followed Villa and Cummings back into the interview room and listened as Villa asked Toole to explain exactly what he was referring to. Toole replied that he had traveled to South Florida in a black over white Cadillac to find a kid to keep for his own. After driving around for some time, he spotted a mall parking lot, pulled in, and saw a young white boy standing outside a Sears store. Toole told the officers that he forced the child into his Cadillac, pulled out of the lot, and ended up on a highway. When the child would not stop screaming and crying, Toole said, he backhanded him in the face with a closed fist and then struck him again in the stomach, at which point the child slumped down in the seat, unconscious. Toole was relieved that the child had stopped making noise, but it was not long before he began to think that he had actually killed the child and that he would have to dispose of the body. He traveled some distance on the freeway, Toole said, exiting a couple of times before he ended up in a remote, swampy area. He parked, took the child out of the car, and laid him face down over a log. He took a long-bladed knife, maybe a machete, from the trunk of the Cadillac and went back to where he had left the boy and cut off his head. It took several blows to accomplish the decapitation, Toole said, and after that he used the blade to dismember the rest of the body and scatter it about the swamp. As he described his actions to Villa, Terry, and Cummings, Toole took care to illustrate how he'd used his knuckles to backhand the boy in the face and his closed fist to hit him in the stomach. He also pantomimed removing the child from the seat of the Cadillac and laying him gently against a log. Crying now, he told the detectives how he decided to keep the child's head at first, tossing it onto the back seat floorboard of the Cadillac. After he had driven a bit, he began to think better of this notion, however, and he pulled over to toss the decapitated head into a drainage ditch or canal of some kind. And after that, Toole said, he drove back to Jacksonville. At the conclusion of the statement, the three detectives stepped out into the hallway, and it was only then that Buddy Terry told Villa and Cummings that it sounded to him like Toole had just repeated, albeit in far more grisly detail, a confession he'd made the previous week, the killing of a child named Adam Walsh, who had been abducted from a Sears store 2 summers previously. Adam's head had been found floating in a canal a couple of weeks after his disappearance, Terry explained, but his body had never been found, and the killer was still on the loose. Via shook his head and glanced back through the window of the interview room where a shaken tool still sat. He'd never heard of the case, Via told Terry, but whatever terrible things had happened, it sure seemed as if they'd found the party responsible. It seemed that way to Buddy Terry, too. But both he and Via were reasonable men, and what developed with Tool from that point on would have little to do with reason. Jacksonville, Florida, October 19, 1983. According to a Hollywood PD supplemental report, 8 days went by before Lieutenant Hines passed along word to lead case detective Jack Hoffman that Buddy Terry of the Jacksonville Sheriff's Office had called with information pertaining to the disappearance and murder of Adam Walsh. Hoffman notes that he returned Terry's call at 3:10 p.m. on Wednesday, October 19th, and by 9 p.m., he and his partner Hickman were in Jacksonville to interview Otis Tool. When they arrived, Terry advised the two that Tool was just finishing up another interview with Detective Villa from Louisiana. Villa was the investigator who had extracted the most specific information from Tool, he explained, and they would likely want to confer with him before talking with Tool themselves. Yes, they did want to talk to Villa, Hoffman told Terry, and with that, the two Hollywood detectives sat tight-lipped until Via came out of the interview room and Terry made introductions around. It didn't take Hoffman long to set the tone for their interchange. He fixed Via with his disdainful stare, then delivered a jaw-dropping accusation. So you're the one who's been feeding Tool details of my investigation. Via stared at the pair across from him, incredulous. I don't know what you're talking about. Via managed finally, glancing at Terry to make sure he hadn't misheard. I was interviewing Otis Tool about a murder in Ouachita Parish, Louisiana, when out of nowhere he started talking about killing some kid in South Florida. Via had the distinct impression that nothing he was saying mattered in the slightest to Hoffman, but still he continued. I got Detective Terry in the room along with my colleague Joe Cummings from Monroe, and asked this Tool to take us through his story from the beginning. When he was finished, I still didn't know who he was talking about. We left Tool in the interview room and went out in the hall to talk, and that's when Detective Terry told me that it sounded like Tool was talking about killing Adam Walsh. That's the first time in my life I even heard the name. Hoffman glanced at Terry then, as if he had just spotted someone else to blame for meddling in his investigation. I'm going to need a written report on this, he said to Via, skepticism saturating his tone. You can read my notes any time you want to, Via said. Furthermore, I don't appreciate your attitude, my friend. I'm trying to do you a favor, and you come in here insinuating I'm leaking information to some douchebag like Otis Tool? Where the hell would I even get it? Apart from another sidelong glance at Terry, there was no response. Can we have him now? Hoffman said, waving toward the interview room. He's all yours, Terry said. You won't mind if I sit in, though, will you? The look Hoffman gave Terry told him that Hoffman very much minded, but there was little the Hollywood detective could do to keep Terry out. He's your prisoner, Hoffman told Terry tersely, and the three moved inside the interview room with Tool. Hoffman introduced himself and his partner Hickman, and told Tool that they were from the Hollywood, Florida Police Department. He offered a standard rights form for Tool to sign, but Tool waved it away. He understood his rights, he told Hoffman, and he understood that he was waiving his right to have an attorney present during the questioning that was about to take place. He didn't read all that well, he told Hoffman, indicating the form on the table before him. He'd only gone through the 7th grade, but he understood the English language well enough, and he understood exactly what they were saying about his rights. With that established, Hoffman asked Tool to give him a statement about what he claimed he'd done down in South Florida, and Tool readily agreed. It was a couple of years ago, he began, when he and his partner Henry Lee Lucas drove down to Fort Lauderdale in a 1973 black-over-white Cadillac that Toole had purchased from a woman in Jacksonville named Faye McNett. Buddy Terry lifted an eyebrow as he heard the mention of Lucas in the matter for the first time, but he said nothing. Toole explained to Hoffman and Hickman that he had been depressed over the death of his mother that May, and that he and Lucas had been traveling around the country, as far as Texas and California, with his niece and nephew Frida and Frank Powell. He told Hoffman that he and Lucas had returned to Jacksonville sometime in June, and that before they set out on the trip to South Florida, he'd taken a Pennsylvania license tag from a car on the street and switched the plate on the caddy. The two of them had snatched a kid from outside a Sears store in a shopping mall, he told Hoffman, who then asked how Toole could be sure it was a Sears. Toole looked at Hoffman as if he were the barely functioning individual in the room. "'Cause I know a Sears when I see a Sears,' he said, as if explaining it to an idiot. He didn't remember actually going inside the Sears, though he may have, he told Hoffman. He was just window shopping and remembered having passed a wig shop when he saw the boy. As to the time of the abduction, however, Toole responded in a way that was typical of his tenuous grasp of matters that most take for granted. "'It would have to have been, the afternoon. I call afternoon around noontime and that.' "'There'd been trouble with the boy in the car,' Toole continued, "'and he'd had to slap and punch him to get him to quiet down. "'Eventually he and Lucas had pulled off the turnpike, "'and Lucas had killed the boy by decapitating him with an 18-inch bayonet "'while Toole held Adam down on his stomach. "'He said Lucas had to hit the kid 3 or 4 times to get his head cut off. "'After that they chopped the boy up and threw his body parts out the window along the turnpike.' They'd kept the head for a while longer because Lucas wanted to have sex with it, Toole said. As to why he was making this confession, Toole told the detectives that he wanted to get it out of his mind. Hoffman next showed Toole the photo of Adam that the family had reproduced on the missing persons flyer, but Toole wasn't sure that it was the same boy that he and Lucas took. When Hoffman showed Toole a second photo in which Adam's hair was wet from swimming, Toole nodded. He believed that the second photo did resemble the boy he killed, he said. With that, Detectives Hoffman and Hickman concluded their interview and left the room, leaving Detective Terry and Otis Toole alone. "'Why are you jerking them around?' Terry asked Toole, his arms folded. "'What are you talking about?' Toole replied. "'You know as well as I do that Henry Lee Lucas was in jail in Maryland when all this happened. What are you trying to pull?' Toole looked away and stared at the wall for a few moments. Finally, he turned back to Terry. Yes, he'd lied about Lucas being involved. "'Tell them detectives I want to talk to them again,' he said to Terry, who shook his head and went to look for Hoffman and Hickman. It was well past midnight when the two detectives from Hollywood came back into the interview room, and Toole announced that he hadn't explained things exactly right the first time around and would like to correct his statement. Hoffman gave Terry a skeptical glance, but nonetheless he and Hoffman sat down and began to take a second recorded statement from Toole. The biggest thing he had to correct was that Henry Lee Lucas hadn't been involved in the crime, Toole told them. Then he set out to explain how things had really happened. Early in July of 1981, he and Lucas had borrowed Toole's brother's 1972 Ford pickup, supposedly to haul some scrap iron to the Jacksonville dump and sell it. In truth, Toole and Lucas lit out of Jacksonville immediately, accompanied by Toole's niece, Frida Powell, 13 at the time, and his nephew, Frank Powell, 12. They'd abandoned the truck in Maryland about a week later, and on the 15th of July, Toole's sister-in-law, Georgia, reported the truck stolen to the Jacksonville sheriff. Toole had gotten separated from Lucas and his niece and nephew, and after a brief hospital stay, had returned to Florida by himself. Meantime, Lucas had been arrested by Delaware police on charges of vehicular theft and remained in jail there well into October. Toole had traveled to South Florida alone, he told Hoffman and Hickman, and ran into Adam Walsh coming out of the Hollywood Sears store on the west side of the building. He enticed the boy into his Cadillac with the promise of candy and toys, then quickly rolled up the windows and locked the doors. Though the engine on the Cadillac had been giving him a little trouble, it wasn't running right, it would just roll off. He got it started and pulled out of the parking lot, with Adam now asking about the toys and the candy. It took him about 10 minutes to get from the store parking lot to Florida's Turnpike, Toole said, and by the time he went through the toll booth to get a ticket, he had to start slapping and hitting the boy to get him to quiet down. The kid was getting on my nerves, Toole said. I hit him quite a bit of times in the car. I think I did knock him out. I'm pretty sure that I knocked that kid out. The rest of his account matched closely with what Toole had already told Detective Kendrick from Brevard County and Detective Villa from Louisiana. He pulled off the turnpike onto a dirt road to kill the child. The child was unconscious when he carried him from the car and laid him face down on the ground, and it took him 4 or 5 blows to sever the child's head. He was unconscious, so I didn't have a hard time chopping his head off, Toole said. I laid him face down, and I did it. Hoffman glanced up at Toole and asked whether he was right-handed or left-handed.
Right-handed, Toole answered.
And you said you kept the head for a while, Hoffman continued. Just where in the car did you put it?
Toole shrugged.
I say I switched it different times. I had it in the back one time on the floorboard, and I ended up putting it in the front floorboard.
After the decapitation, Toole said that he dismembered and scattered the body parts, then got back onto the turnpike and drove another 10 minutes or so northward before he began to think better of keeping the head. When he spotted a bridge railing up ahead, he told Hoffman, "I stopped the car and got out, and I throwed the head over in the canal."
"How about the boy's clothes?" Hoffman asked.
"Oh, his clothes were in the car," Toole said.
While he was stopped, he used the clothes to wipe up some of the blood off the seat and then tossed the clothes out.
"Or maybe he had thrown the clothes away in a dumpster in one of the roadside rest stops," Toole said, "for that is what he remembered doing with his own blood-soaked clothes."
"I throwed them in the dumpster."
"And all this blood on his clothes had come from the child?" Hoffman wanted to be sure.
"Not only on his clothes, but on his shoes as well," Toole assured the detective. "I throwed my shoes away, too, and put on another pair."
He'd then driven on back to Jacksonville and junked the car at a yard on Holloway Avenue, Toole said, and that was pretty much the end of that story. But why had he lied to them and implicated Henry Lee Lucas in his first statement, Hoffman wanted to know.
"Because I figured I could tie him up in it and get even with his ass," Toole said.
"And you also said that Henry Lee got a blowjob from the head," Hoffman continued, looking up from his notes. "Was that really you that got the blowjob from the head?"
Toole shook his head at the question.
"No," he said dismissively, "I didn't even fuck it."
Hoffman then withdrew a third photograph of Adam and laid it beside the other two he'd already shown Toole. "Was this the boy he was talking about?" the detective asked. Toole studied the third photograph briefly, then glanced at Hoffman.
The other pictures look more like him than that one does," Toole said.
But still there seemed no doubt in his mind.
"Yes, I'd say. Yes, that's him."
It was almost 2 in the morning by the time Hoffman and Hickman wound up their second interview with Toole.
"If we take you back down to South Florida with us, can you show us the places you've been talking about? This Sears store, the place where you decapitated the child, and where you threw his head in the canal?"
"I guess so," Toole said.
"We'll let you know," Hoffman said, and with that, the interview was finished.
Once again, it might seem to any sentient observer that every element was in hand for a swift delivery of justice, or as swift as one is permitted in a system as full of checks and balances as our own. An individual with a history of violent behavior has made 3 unbidden confessions of murder to law officers from 3 different jurisdictions, providing details obviously known previously only to the medical examiners and the detectives in charge of the case. Surely justice was about to be dispensed. How could it possibly not be? Jacksonville, Florida, October 21st, 1983. In the early hours following his second conversation with Toole, Detective Hoffman,
Whether or not he was miffed that his theory about Jimmy Campbell had been discredited, or simply that someone other than he and his partner Hickman had found Otis Toole and extracted a confession from him, went quickly to work securing an order from a Duval County circuit judge, allowing the two of them and Detective Terry to transport Toole to Hollywood for the purposes of identifying the purported crime scenes he had described. Meanwhile, Toole returned to his cell in the county lockup, where he began to pace and mutter, waking his cellmate, James Collins.
"What was the matter?" Collins asked. "He was trying to get some sleep."
Toole glanced around the cell nervously, then leaned close. What did Collins suppose other inmates would do to someone who had murdered children? Toole wondered, his voice low. Collins wasn't sure what might happen, but he did think that Toole was unusually agitated. Toole went on to explain to Collins that the cops had found the head of this kid he'd killed, and that now they wanted him to go down to Fort Lauderdale and help them find the body. "I just hope it ain't there," Toole said, and then he went back to his pacing and muttering. Collins never told anyone whether he actually did get back to sleep that night. Ordinary people might have had great difficulty doing so. But if men believed everything they heard in prison, there'd be precious little sleep enjoyed there. At 9 on Friday morning, Toole was escorted by Detectives Hoffman and Terry from the Duval County Jail and flown by private plane to the North Perry Airport in Pembroke Pines, not far from Hollywood. They were met at about 11:30 by two other detectives from Hollywood PD and driven by van to the nearby sprawling Broward Mall, which contained a Sears store. "This was definitely not the place," Toole said as they pulled into the huge lot. The lot outside the store where he'd taken the boy was much smaller, and the mall had been a single-story structure, not a two-story like this one. From the Broward Mall, they drove next to a Sears store that sat just off Federal Highway in Fort Lauderdale. But again, Toole shook his head. This was not the place. Detective Larry Hoisington of the Hollywood PD, who had been assigned to drive the team, was behind the wheel. Hoisington next drove to I-95 and piloted them the few miles south toward Hollywood. As they pulled off the exit ramp at Hollywood Boulevard, Toole gazed intently out the van windows. "This looks like the road I got off on," he told the detectives. As they passed the train station that abuts the boulevard there, Toole noted that the area looked familiar to him. "I think the store is up there," he said, pointing to the right. Hoisington glanced in the rearview mirror to be sure which way Toole was directing them. Owing to his various deficiencies, Toole never used such words as left or right, north or south, east or west, just hand motions and phrases like over there and down that way. Hoisington followed Toole's gesture, and a few blocks farther pulled the van off Hollywood Boulevard and into the lot on the east side of the Sears store. He circled the store to the north, then turned along its west facade where the garden shop was located. "This is it," Toole said, pointing. "This is where I picked up the kid." Hoffman glanced around at his colleagues, then noted the time on his watch. He directed Hoisington to drive the few hundred yards to Hollywood PD for lunch before they started out for the turnpike. After lunch, however, Toole asked if they could take one more look at the Sears lot, just so he could be sure. Hoisington took them back to the north entrance where the catalog store was located and parked the van. After a few moments, Toole nodded again. This was the place. He was more than sure of it. He pointed to a nearby bus bench located in the lot beneath an overhang. He'd been standing right there when he saw the boy come walking out of the doors by the garden department. He repeated his story of luring Adam into the Cadillac with the promises of toys and candy, and then showed the officers where he pulled out of the lot and made a right turn on Hollywood Boulevard, heading west toward Florida's turnpike. It took about 10 minutes, Toole told them, recalling there was a sharp bend in the road somewhere along the way. When Hoisington took them around a traffic circle on Hollywood Boulevard, Toole glanced out at a school located there and confirmed that this was the road he remembered driving on. To test Toole, Hoisington decided that he purposely would not exit the roundabout where Hollywood Boulevard continued west toward the turnpike.
Instead, he continued on toward the south exit of the roundabout. Toole laughed at that.
"I did the same thing you just did," he told Hoisington. "You were supposed to turn back there."
Hoisington glanced at Hoffman, but if he expected any recognition of his cleverness, none was forthcoming.
"Take the right fucking turn, will you?" Hoffman growled.
At the northbound turnpike entrance, Hoisington brought down the van window to take a toll ticket. Toole said that he remembered doing the same thing the day he had Adam in his car. As they passed through the second toll plaza on the route north, Toole told the detectives it was where he'd pulled over to quiet the kid down. Adam had been crying for his mother, Toole explained, and he had to beat him until he was unconscious to get him to stop. By 3:30 p.m., as they clicked past mile marker 126 on the turnpike, well over an hour north of Hollywood, the van whisked beneath an overpass, and Toole pointed out the window toward the side of the road.
"Hey, this is where I got off at," he called.
Hoisington pulled the van to the shoulder of the turnpike, and, just as Toole had when he overshot the nearly hidden exit, backed cautiously to the service road leading to a desolate construction staging area.
"You can pull off into there," Toole said, pointing. "This is where I stopped and killed the kid."
Hoffman told Toole to direct them to the place where he'd left Adam's body, and a shackled, handcuffed Toole gave it his best, even though he told them his memory was a little hazy. He'd been pretty intoxicated at the time, he said. He thought there was a fork in the road, to be quite honest, but there were no turnoffs to be found. Just a straight shot down the service road through the pine barrens to a spot where the road petered out at a guardrail blocking the road.
"It was over in there someplace," Toole said, and a dubious Hoffman led his men, along with Detective Terry, out for an inspection of the area.
While Hoffman and the others tramped about the desolate woods, Hoisington and Toole sat alone inside the van. Hoisington had been ordered by Hoffman not to speak with Toole.
"You're here for one reason, to drive the goddamn van, okay?"
And he was not about to start trouble. But Toole seemed agitated now, and the longer they sat together, the more restless he became.
"I killed a lot of people," he blurted to Hoisington suddenly. "But of all I did, I wished I hadn't killed that little kid."
Toole indicated the area where the others were walking with a nod of his head. Hoisington followed Toole's gesture, but said nothing.
"It was right here," Toole said, tears welling in his eyes. "I took him out of the car and carried him yonder into the woods, and I cut off his head with a machete I always carried."
He went on to explain how he'd dragged the body into the brush and covered it with leaves. He came back to the spot where he'd left Adam's head and took it back to the car and tossed it on the floor behind the driver's seat. Hoisington knew that Toole was a suspect in the murder of Adam Walsh, of course, but he had no idea of the details of Toole's confessions. Everything that Toole was recounting to him sounded like the stuff of a nightmare.
"Why did you keep the head?" Hoisington heard himself asking.
Toole glanced at him as if he were explaining why you'd duck undercover when it started to rain.
"He'd already sodomized Adam's body," he told Hoisington. "I was going to have sex with the head later on."
As a cop, Hoisington had heard his fair share, but Toole's offhand declaration was enough to make his stomach heave. With great relief, he saw an obviously irritated Hoffman leading his group back toward the van.
"We can't see anything over there," Hoffman grumbled as he climbed in, waving vaguely toward the tangle of vines and underbrush on the far side of the guardrail.
He slapped at a mosquito on his neck, one of a cloud that followed him through the open door. It had been more than 2 years, the hot and frustrated detectives reasoned as they piled back into the van. A jungle could spring up around here in that amount of time. Heavy equipment would have to be brought in. Meantime, Hoffman declared, Toole could show them where he'd disposed of the head.
"Sure," Toole assured them.
It wasn't far, no more than 10 minutes from where they were parked. Hoisington piloted them back down the rocky trail, then waited for a break in the traffic to pull back on the highway. It wasn't like they'd pulled off into a paved rest area where there was some nicely banked re-entry road. The very maneuver to regain the highway in a sluggish 9-passenger van was not without risk. Some hopped-up kid in a fast car comes up too quickly behind them, they'd all be toast. And all because of a scumbag like Tool? What a way to go. Still, Hoisington managed it without incident, and had hardly got them back up to cruising speed when Tool called out again, this time near mile marker 130. The group exited the van at roadside this time, and Tool directed them a few yards eastward to the bank of a nearby canal, where a wooden dock jutted out over the water. He'd walked out onto the dock there and thrown the head into the water, Tool said. Detective Hoffman, who was well aware that they were standing near the spot where Adam's head had been discovered by fishermen more than 2 years previously, said nothing to his colleagues. It was after 6 p.m. by this time, and Tool said he was hungry and wondered if there was anything to eat. Detective Hoisington handed Tool one of the sandwiches they'd brought along, but another detective swatted it out of Tool's hand.
"You don't need to do this guy any favors," Hoffman told Hoisington. "He's just jerking us around."
Tool glanced at the sandwich that had landed in the dirt.
"Fuck you," he said to Hoffman.
"No," Hoffman replied, "fuck you."